time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Jerry Haynes. Jerry Haynes is with Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility, and she is the organizer for the medical service delegations that regularly go to Gaza. Jerry, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us again this morning.
Thank you, Mike.
So you and your organization, WPSR, are planning on doing a delegation to Gaza coming up this coming October, just
right. Yes,
a little over a month away.
We plan to leave the United States at the end of October and stay into November, probably the 10th or 12th of November, go into Gaza. It takes a day to get there and then a day to get in, and hopefully we'll be able to serve in the hospitals and clinics there. We are looking forward to helping some of our colleagues in Gaza set up some training programs that will be ongoing so that we don't just go in and do immediate work, which we will do, but also set up long-term training programs for people and things like trauma residency is one of our goals. And I'll be working with the School of Nursing on setting up a grief and bereavement program. So we're looking forward to that time to be with them. We anticipate that we will find a lot of devastation, and we know that our colleagues and our host in the Gaza Community Mental Health Program have all been traumatized by what has been going on over these last weeks. So we're anticipating also working on that kind of trauma response.
And you had just been there in April?
Yes, we were there in April, and we took in surgeons, and one of the surgeons is a trauma surgeon from Harborview, and he has now formed collegial relationships with people there to begin this training program.
And you attempted to get into Gaza just a few weeks ago, but the fighting is, Israel is not allowing you in?
Well, no, it isn't. We don't know that Israel isn't allowing us in. We were invited to apply to come in, and so we put together a team of two neurosurgeons and a trauma surgeon, an ICU trauma nurse, a cardiologist, and myself, and we were going to go in and see what we could do just to be helpful over a period of a couple of weeks. But our application was never answered. UNRWA, the United Nations Relief Works Association, which feeds over, probably 70% of the people in Gaza, and the World Health Organization were helping to host us, but we just didn't ever get an answer. Now, whether that's because the application process failed or we weren't allowed, we don't know, and we will never know that. But now we'll apply again to go in October at the end.
All right. So you have been in constant communication with friends and colleagues?
Yes, I am in constant communication. I've called there nearly every day and talked with one friend who works at the Gaza Community Mental Health Program. And I, in fact, talked with him this morning and I said to him, what would he like us to be able to know here in the United States about what's happening in Gaza? And his first words were, we want peace. We want peace. We are so tired of being constantly on the alert for bombs. People have gone back into their bombed-out homes because they would prefer to be in the place of their homes. And he has one friend who said to him yesterday, you know, I'm going to go back to my home even though it's not habitable right now, but as soon as this ends, I'll build one room and I'll stay there because this is a sacred place for me to be in my own home. And I have a friend whose mother and three brothers were killed, and I know that he will be looking at how he reconstructs his life. A lot of the people that we know are also caregivers because we go in with medical people, and so we know right now that the medical caregivers are also traumatized. The Palestinian Medical Relief Committee says that probably between 150 and 200,000 children are in need of psychological support because they're brothers and sisters were killed, their parents are killed, the death is all around, the destruction is all around. Probably they estimate that at least 1,500 children are now totally orphans. So the amount of real trauma is hard to quantify. We can only think that if this happened in Seattle, we would be, well, we'd be devastated, just like the 1.8 million people in Gaza are devastated. Gaza is such a small place. It's only about the length of Lake Washington and about 5 miles average wide. So 1.7 to 1.8 million people in that space, and a good third of the agricultural land is off limits to them, so the space becomes even more crowded, and the population density grows even higher. You can see that once the bombing by Israel started in these intensely populated areas, there was a lot of destruction and devastation.
As many of the photos clearly show, homes, apartment buildings, schools, hospitals, the university, they're just completely destroyed.
Yes. The Islamic University was reconstructed after the 2008-2009 bombings by Israel, and we've all taught there at Islamic University and know something about the way they have handled their teaching mechanisms, which are very forthright, very forward-looking, and we teach in English, and they learn in English. Their medical students chart in English. And now this beautiful building that they are building, these many buildings that they constructed are destroyed, or at least partially destroyed. Very sad.
The mainstream media liked to cover that at the beginning, anyway, of this latest attack by Israel, that there were leaflets dropped saying, you know, giving people a chance to get out. But my understanding is we're in a crowded situation like that, where are you going to go?
Yeah. The leafleting, or what they call knocking on the roof of a house, is it's so awful, so sad, because if I am in a house and there are now 100 people in my house because some of them have had their homes destroyed, and now you knock on my roof and tell me that get out, you have 3 or 4 minutes to get out, where am I going to go with 100 people in an area that is so intensely populated that there really is nowhere to run? And really, I know of several instances where those knocks occurred. People left their homes and then waited for 15 minutes or so, up to maybe 3 hours, went back in, and then their house was destroyed with the people in it. So the knocking is such an odd thing, to think that that's a justification for killing all of these people. Now, the number that we get this morning is 2,076 people have been killed. I understand that there's one Israeli child that was killed by a rocket in the last couple of days, and that's a tragedy. In my work, I work with parents whose children have died. I have a pretty good understanding of the devastation that occurs in the heart of parents when their child has died. There are hundreds of children who have been killed in Gaza. There's no way to quantify the sorrow and the long-term effects of your child being killed by violence. But the volume in Gaza is so enormous that the population is what we call continuously stressed and traumatized. We don't talk about post-traumatic stress injury in Gaza. We talk about continuous traumatic stress injury in Gaza, because always these children are on the alert. The parents are on the alert. One of the problems that happens too is that the children who in a normal situation look to their parents for protection now begin to realize that no one can protect them, because everyone is at risk.
And the stress is also based on the fact that this current attack has been going on so long. For what week are we in now? It's the longest one that they've endured so far.
It's been going on since July 8th, I believe. So that's a long time, you know. And now there was that 8-day, well, there have been several ceasefires. And, of course, Israel blames Gaza for breaking the ceasefires and and Gaza blames Israel for breaking the ceasefires. And there's so much finger pointing that it's hard to know about who to blame. And really, it's sort of not very functional to do that. The fact is that there was a three-day ceasefire that was extended for 5 days, and then it was broken. And at that point, then there was more bombing, and there were more rockets, and there were collaborators killed, and you know, the whole thing has just become so incredibly wearisome and horrifying to the people who are under constant attack or under threat of constant attack that we have to put ourselves in the place of those folks and try to imagine what that would be. I know it's impossible, but having been in Gaza maybe 20 times since 1993, I begin to have a feeling about what that would be to be in one of those concrete buildings and have the sound of a drone go over. When we were there in April, there were drones going overhead constantly. You could hear this sound of the drone going over. And now what isn't reported very much is that the people of Gaza live with that almost constant sound of drones. And the drones are dangerous because they're armed. They're weapons in and of themselves. So it isn't just the shelling from boats, and it isn't just the shelling from tanks, and it isn't just the bombing overhead. All of those things far more destructive than rockets coming out of Gaza. But it's also this constant application of the horrifying little insidious sound of a drone going over, knowing that the drone could fire at you at any moment.
And as one of the articles on your Facebook page pointed out, by about a gentleman that runs a medical facility there, the drones can actively see what's going on. So when they fire at a medical facility that injured people are in, you know, there's just no fallback for that in terms of excuses.
No, and really medical people have been hurt or killed. Ambulances have been targeted and ambulance drivers killed. Many journalists have been killed. So you have to think about if their pinpoint targeting by Israel of the people in Gaza is true, then there are lots of mistakes being made, or the targeting is pretty horrible. And I understand the rockets are without the same kind of targeting, the rockets that come from Gaza into Israel. But the destruction done by the rockets is, of course, minuscule. Not that that four-year-old boy falls into that category, or that those 64 soldiers fall into that category, because 64 soldiers' families are now devastated, and the four civilians of Israel, those families are devastated. And the 2,076 families of the people in Gaza are devastated. And there is no quantifying any of that on a personal basis.
So we here in the U.S. have a role in this. It isn't just something that is, although the media presents it that way, it's something far removed. It's not so far removed from the financial and military support we give to Israel.
Well, our press is known for being pretty much biased toward things like if you hear that someone in Israel was killed, you hear that someone in Gaza died. There's a subtle difference in that, and yet it's not very subtle. The terrorist kills an Israeli. The Israeli does what he does, and then people die. And I have many friends in Israel who want that to stop. So I think it's essential to note that the movement for peace is not just from the people of Gaza, but also from hundreds of thousands of people in Israel who are wanting both the Hamas government and the Israeli government to step forward like real humanitarians and end this disaster. whether the disaster is brought about by a natural gas reservoir, which exists off the coast of Gaza and has had almost no press here, but is well acknowledged by the people of Gaza as being an enlivening factor for all of this. We don't know that. We don't know all of the subtleties behind what's happened. What we see is the result of the failure of our human soul to come to some kind of way to rectify the inability of people to come to peace. So somehow or other, we have learned to play unfairly in the world. And if the United States is supplying weapons that are killing people in Gaza, then I feel a personal responsibility about that. I feel my tax dollars are going to kill my friends in Gaza. I don't like that at all. And I met with Jim McDermott about that. And we know, he knows that this has to stop. We know that there has to be a way to come to some kind of sense of responsibility as human beings about stopping this killing. We just haven't found the path yet. Some time ago, Archbishop Hunthausen said regarding the Iraq war, we need to put the leaders of the world in a room together and require that they give one another a benevolent glance before they can do anything about moving toward war. I'd like to see that kind of wisdom perpetuated.
So has anyone so far put forward plans for ceasefire and or peace in this situation?
Yes. Of course, the Israelis want a complete disarmament of Gaza, and they have some ideas about what will work and what won't work. The people of Gaza have a 10-point plan for a 10-year truce that they've presented to Israel, and so far the Israelis have not moved on making sure that could happen. But from my reading of it, those points on their 10-point plan are not unreasonable. They want an end to the siege. They want to be able to move freely back and forth between themselves and the West Bank, so there could be a corridor established. They'd like to have a seaport. They'd like to have open fishing. You know, the restrictions on fishing in Gaza are horrible because right now, fully and partially untreated sewage runs right into the Mediterranean Sea, and the fishermen of Gaza, who used to provide a major part of the protein source for people of Gaza, are not allowed out further than 3 nautical miles, and so they're fishing in polluted water. They want to be able to go out into the ocean, into the sea, to be able to fish in fresh water. They also want to be able to build sewage treatment plants and have free access to electricity. Right now, their electricity is very sporadic. During the height of this conflict, they were without electricity for days on end, or only had 2 or 3 hours of electricity. Now they're having maybe 4 hours on and 12 hours off, or maybe 6 hours on and 12 hours off, depending on where they live in Gaza. But it's hot there now, you know, and to have no way to make sure that your food is safe or that you have clean drinking water. And it's a humanitarian disaster in Gaza as well as a medical disaster. The public health of Gaza has been almost destroyed. Right now, also in Gaza, the communicable disease problem is accelerating incredibly. They're having a lot of scabies, which is a highly contagious disease. And when people are living 100 to a house, it's hard to avoid being mutually infected. And so they don't have an adequate medicine for the treatment of scabies. They're seeing dehydration and a lot of GI problems, that gastrointestinal problems, that is vomiting, diarrhea, and no clean water to clean that up with. And that you can imagine that these problems that are medical accelerate into just ongoing problems that are contagious and carry with them also psychological trauma. So they haven't had yet an outbreak of cholera that I'm aware of, but that sort of seems to be on the public health route, maybe the next thing that they're going to be looking for. But scabies is really a problem for them right now.
And right now, it doesn't appear that any other organizations, any third party, either nations or NGOs, are getting in to be able to help the situation?
Sure. Egypt is really trying, you know. Well, Egypt is the place of negotiation. How much that trial is ongoing, we don't know. John Kerry, as you know, went over and tried to broker a peace between, and that apparently just didn't work. Other Arab nations have had things to say, but other Arab nations have not brought a lot of pressure to bear on this. And no, there are all sorts of conjectures about that that probably aren't worth getting into here in this short amount of time about who pays who what money to make sure that people hold off on their demands. But it's a problem that other nations might be demanding and probably could demand more than they are. The United Nations has certainly stood up to say this has to end.
Again, prior to this latest military attacks, I mean, Gaza physically was in bad shape to begin with. You mentioned one of the peace plans items was stopping the siege, which has been going since 2007. Is that right? The siege of Gaza.
Yeah. Stopping the siege would mean, opening the borders and allowing medicines to flow in freely, allowing the transfer of agricultural goods in and out. What's happened in Gaza, which was a highly agricultural area, is that because of the siege, they have not been able to fully export the things that they raise. Also, because the Gaza aquifer has been overpumped and the seawater is flowing into their aquifer, the water that they get is salinized. So, you know, if you water your crops with salinized water, the crops don't do as well. So water is a huge, huge issue there in Gaza. And ending the siege would mean a way to desalinize the water or to put water free-flowing into the aquifer. Right now, Israel has drilled wells along the long land border, and they take fresh water that might refill the aquifer. So as the population of Gaza has just climbed and climbed and climbed from 1 million to 1.2 million, now approaching 2 million people, the overpumping of that aquifer has become a terrible problem. They get water in trucks, maybe from Israel, and Israel will reports that they send in food and that they administer things through UNRWA. It's just not sufficient for the population.
And so many of these things people should be able to relate to here, because in a way we're dealing with similar problems, but on a much smaller scale, of course, like bringing trucks of water to Detroit. Right. And you see how absurd that is. It's like, you know, pardon the pun, it's a drop in the bucket for what people need.
That's right. So if we begin to see that on a minuscule scale, really, that we know that that's not an answer. The answer is to allow people to have fuel to cook with, to allow people to have fuel to drive with, all aspects of our life that we can imagine that make us mobile and functional are missing or highly curtailed in Gaza because of the siege. There are people who are able to go out for medical care, but there are people who are not able to go out for medical care. In April, when we came through the border, there was a young woman holding her baby in an ambulance at the border, and the baby was being taken out for open heart surgery in Jerusalem, which was fine. The baby went to a Palestinian hospital in Jerusalem, and we actually visited that baby in Jerusalem a couple of weeks after the transfer was made, but the mother was not allowed to go with him. So the aspects of siege are tiny and huge and pervasive and absolutely limit the way people can live a life that has high quality and is always fearful.
We're talking with Jerry Haynes. She is with Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility and organizer of medical delegations to Gaza. And again, you are organizing a delegation coming up this October. Can you talk about that and how people can support that?
Sure. We are going in October. We hope we are going to get permission to go in October through the Eretz checkpoint between Israel and Gaza. There are about 15 of us who are queuing up to go, and we are hoping that people will support that. We all pay our own way. We are volunteers. Physicians take their time off. Nurses take their time off. I, who am not employed, I can go more freely. But we take in medicines and medical supplies, and this time we are hoping to help establish, for the first time in over 40 years, a children's library in central Gaza in a place called Deir al-Bala. And so anyone who would like to contribute to that could make a tax-deductible donation to Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility, www.wpsr.org. And those monies will be fully 100% used to purchase medical supplies and medicines and books or some aspect of the library.
And as well as, can people with medical backgrounds participate in your delegation?
We're looking for medical specialists for this delegation because there are the siege has resulted in medical people not being able to go out and get continuing education in the way that they were free to go before the siege. And so what we're hoping is that we will take in instructors as well as practitioners so we can help uplift the medical practitioners in what they're doing. And again, as I said earlier, that we want to help them form medical training programs in areas where they have not been able to do that because of the siege. There's a young pediatric urologist that has traveled with us, and he's a world expert in what he does. And he has really been teaching people over these last five journeys into Gaza how to do some of the things that he does. And we're hoping now that the trauma surgeon will do the same thing for us.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us again this morning.
Mike, it's always an absolute treasure to be with you. Thank you.
Again, we've been talking with Jerry Haynes. She is with Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility and the organizer of their medical delegations to Gaza. And you can find out more about Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility at their website, wpsr.org.